let me just press record on my voice recorder.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
I'm just going to put it on my laptop and I'm going to keep these headphones on. And if I say I'm going to the freezer,
take the headphones off
like this before I do, because I'm otherwise just going to walk away with my laptop.
This is To Be Delicious, a Lekka mini-series looking at food heritage through the lens of umami and the ingredient of MSG. I'm Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing, a writer and academic who is particularly interested in looking at ingredients as a way to understand the world we live in. Across 5 episodes, we're speaking to chefs, academics, cooks and bartenders to explore some of my research into how MSG is part of our culinary heritage. Each episode is self-contained, but the series will make more sense if you start from episode 1 and listen in order. So if you haven't done that already, go back and listen. In this episode, we dive into umami's connection to nostalgia and how it ties to our craving for comfort. Nostalgia is, of course, a very tricky concept. It is a longing for home, but it isn't always something that is comforting. Not everyone's memories of home are comforting. And sometimes nostalgia can be dangerous, as it paints a picture of a time that never really existed. In this episode, we wanted to speak to people who have moved from their home countries and understand what food they seek to remind them or to anchor them in their heritage. What happens when food, or even language, travels? We're cooking with novelist and cookbook writer Kate Young and speaking with a number of other people who have made the UK their home. Part of the story of migration and what foods we bring along with us is a story about the everyday umami-rich dishes that make us feel at home wherever we are. Along with people moving, food moves too. It is thought that with the expansion of the Roman Empire across Europe and into Britain, the foods of the Roman nation came with it. One of those things was garum. I have read that Britain had the flavour of umami in their food, but lost it with the end of the Romans in Britain. I don't agree with that. I think there has been umami in British food for a very long time, and now with migrant communities, we have even more. Before we get started in the landscape of today's food culture, I did want to quickly understand what garum is. You might be familiar with this word, as it has come back into vogue recently, as is often the way with specific ingredients tied to time and place. There's now even a high-end Italian restaurant in West London called garum. So to kick off this episode, I wanted to delve into this ancient food that travelled to Britain. And who better than Dr. Johnny Drain to explain a few things.
I think I first came across the concept of garum when I was at the Nordic Food Lab back in 2014. It's a Roman word, and so it refers to a Roman fish sauce. Now, of course, there are all sorts of different fish sauces, fermented fish sauces from all around the world, but the ones they had in Rome were called garum, and I believe the word and the techniques probably came from North Africa. But the recipe was essentially that you would take fish with their guts, and you would salt them, and you would put them into clay pots, or you would lay them on the roof for a little bit to dry them out. And essentially the enzymes that are in the fish guts, and that's not unique to fishes. You've got enzymes in your guts that help you break down food. But those enzymes basically start breaking down the fish's flesh. And so you go from having fish muscle to having smaller amino acids and proteins. And so the fish liquefies and you end up with this salty, umami-rich fish sauce, which has these types of amino acids like glutamates, which are very umami. So you end up with something that is very savory and fishy and salty. And, you know, my understanding is that it's probably used in the same way that people use hot sauce or ketchup these days. You know, people put ketchup on like lasagna, on curry, on chips, on all sorts of weird things. Never heard of anybody putting ketchup on breakfast cereal, but maybe they do. These Romans were just whacking this garum on lots of stuff. It was their go-to condiment. And then I guess in this sort of, you know, fermentation renaissance, which restaurants like Noma have been at the heart of, and what we did in the Cub Cave with people like Ryan and Doug, what we've done at Silo.
Dr. Drain is referring to Ryan Chetty-Wardner, who you'll hear in the next episode, and chef Doug McMaster of Silo.
There's been a lot of elasticity with the labels that we use to refer to ferments or types of ferments. Some of these labels, these words, have probably been somewhat abused. So we have words like miso and soy sauce. Certainly the word miso is a Japanese word. Soy sauce is obviously a kind of interpretation of a Japanese-Chinese concept. But we have this word garum, which had a very specific meaning, fish sauce. But it has come to encompass a bunch of different connected ferments. So different people use it in different ways. You know, Noma, for example, released a mushroom garum. My particular usage, and I guess I've been somewhat key in popularizing some things within the UK. So if you look around the London fermentation scene or the UK fermentation scene, you know, you might see people echoing this particular usage. But rightly or wrongly, what I've ended up using the word garum to describe is ferments that involve animal protein, so meat or fish, that have been broken down using enzymes, whether that's enzymes endogenic to the fish, or using things like koji, so filamentous fungi that have produced enzymes. So when I talk about garums, often I'm talking about like muntjac, you know, deer garums or fish garums or fancy Mangalitsa pork garums, but basically anything that's got some kind of animal-based protein and has been broken down and liquefied, I've ended up calling that a garum.
As Johnny says, there are fermented fish sauces from all around the world. As a Southeast Asian person, so much of the food of my childhood has fermented fish. Malaysian sambals usually have fish paste in them. And although there is umami in a lot of food, people are travelling, there is a globalisation of food systems, there's communities of diaspora in all corners of the world, and that has meant that we now have access to so many types of umami-rich ingredients.
When I look at condiment sections in supermarkets in my lifetimes, let's say 5, 10, 15 years, I've been really focused on food. I've seen a lot of changes. You know, when I grew up in Birmingham in like the 1980s and early 90s, and you could get Amoy soy sauce, and there was dark and there was light, and my vision, my understanding of what soy sauce was like, that's what soy sauce is. There's two types and it tastes like this. And then I remember someone gave me some not particularly fancy soy sauce, but it was from Japan and it was in a carton, so definitely not fancy. And I tasted it and it like blew my mind. I was like, what the heck is this? Suddenly my conception of the universe of soy sauces and what they could be instantaneously expanded. And now when you walk down into Tesco's or Sainsbury's, there's multiple different types of soy sauce and there's all these other condiments. But, you know, we've had things like gentleman's relish and we've had Worcestershire sauce, which is made with fermented fish traditionally. It's such an easy hack to make things taste better. You can be a bad cook, and if you have access to, you know, ketchup, your vinegar and your soy sauce and your garum, any combination of those things, and you see, you know, them being the fundamentals of lots of dipping sauces and dressings and stock from in lots of different cuisines in the world. If you just like glug those into whatever you're making or on the top, some cheese on toast, whatever, it will taste better.
Talking with Johnny about garum, it made me think about different umami-rich sauces and seasonings popular with specific places. In the UK, for example, is Worcestershire sauce, also a fermented fish-based sauce. Or Henderson's relish if you're from Sheffield, or vegan, as this version doesn't contain fish. And we can find so many examples of this in places all over the world. And when people from these places move around, the approach to flavour and seasoning moves with them.
It is important that we, in this episode, discuss chicken salt as a thing and a presence in my life and a love in my teenage years that I have every time I go back to Australia.
One of the things I was really surprised when I came to the UK was that the KFC didn't have chicken salt.
Right?
And I was like, What? This, I mean, what? This isn't KFC.
You might know Kate Young from her Little Library Cookbook series, beautiful, nostalgic books based on delicious recreations of recipes and literature. She's now writing novels, as well as other food-related books.
It was a thing that was developed in South Australia for rotisserie chickens. So it's a seasoning that is kind of salt mainly, but also MSG and some other sort of dried spices and things. And there's now like infinite varieties of it. So it's not actually sort of a codified recipe, but it is something that if you go and get what in Australia you would refer to as hot chips, i.e. not room temperature chips, which are crisps. So when you go and get hot chips, you want hot chips with chicken salt. And it's kind of like lurid yellow. It is absolutely fantastic. It gives chips this like incredibly Moorish. Chips are already good. Like chips don't need help to be even better, but they are just so good with chicken salt. I started working in food when I was in my teenage years. So I worked first at a fish and chip shop. And working in a fish and chip shop, I would say 90% of people who came in getting fish and chips were getting chicken salt on their chips. It's a huge thing. It's not like a niche thing that you might do. It is like the thing that you do.
Kate was born in England, moved to Australia when she was 2, and then came back in her early 20s.
My family is a family who spend a lot of our, I guess, emotional time and energy on food. So on hosting each other, on always being in other people's houses, on always taking food round, on always having dinner parties, I had sort of a really strong food culture surrounding me. And that is, my parents divorced when I was quite young, but that is like both sides of my family and all my grandparents, everyone was really into what we were eating. And I grew up in Brisbane, in the inner northwest suburbs of Brisbane, which are extraordinarily sort of white of various varieties, but mostly white communities. My family is, I think, English, Dutch, and Irish, but have been in Australia for sort of about somewhere between 150 and, it's almost 200 years now, because we had a convict in our ancestry, which is a thing that Australians love to tell you about themselves and their family history. So we've sort of been a real collection of, I guess, Northern European immigrants of various sorts over various decades and centuries. And so, yeah, that was my sort of growing up. I think my family are quite diverse in our cooking, in that my dad's parents were quite sort of classic English influenced. So they would have a roast on a Sunday, and they would have like sort of the evening meals during the week would feel quite influenced by England, I think. Whereas my mum's family was sort of, my grandma traveled quite a lot and was always coming back with really interesting things. So she had a tandoor oven on her back deck when I was in my teenage years. And she was in New Mexico for a while, so came back really interested in chilies and how they could be used differently in different things and, you know, in multiple different varieties. So I had a sort of influence from lots of different sides and angles. I would say that because we were in Queensland, where it's quite humid, it's quite outdoors lifestyle, I ate a lot of barbecues, I ate a lot of salads, I had a lot of seafood, a lot of tropical fruit. So it was a real mix, and I think that it had a real impact on me in terms of just always being interesting, being quite, I guess, like sort of open with how I cook and where I'm taking things from and what I'm influenced by, and going on a trip somewhere and going, oh my gosh, I'm going to adopt this thing or bring this back or start including this ingredient or working with this thing, or going out and eating dinner and coming home and wanting to make it and wanting and feeling like that's a thing I can do as well.
I was curious how her cooking has been influenced by this upbringing and now by her movement across the globe.
I think that early on, so much of it wasn't so much recreating dishes that I'd been eating in Australia as it was recreating the feeling of having people around a table together.
I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to interview you is because you do use MSG in your cooking.
I do.
And so umami is, essential to what you do, but also this idea of using seasoning, the MSG as a seasoning. Can you talk a little bit about how you do, how you use MSG?
I think that it is something that I have always been aware of. I think certainly when I was a teenager, it, and I was like learning about cooking for the first time, I was learning about cooking at school, I was learning about cooking at home. There was a lot of misinformation, which is why, you know, why it's in a consciousness, why people discuss it, why people talk about it. But I remember like thinking, that's in the chicken salt at work and it tastes great. And sort of going to my dad, who is a research scientist, and going, what does this mean? He's like, oh yeah, that was one study and it actually has been disproved and there's no real evidence to it and you're totally fine, like chicken salt's great. And it was a real sort of sense of, yeah, this is like a chemical compound that people can identify and sort of show you what it is. Like, there is no reason that this would be a thing that you can't eat or that is going to make you feel a different way to other foods. But what it does do is round out flavor fantastically, particularly umami flavor, savory flavor, that it just sort of, particularly, I think with, I really love it in dishes where you are browning meat. I think that that's why it works so well in mince on toast. I think that the sort of Maillard reaction and the way that mince tastes when you don't like boil it in liquid, but you brown it first and get color on it and get that flavor. I think the MSG, the way that it works with that savory flavor is so good. And it just makes everything sort of like more complete, more whole. It's, you know, really, I think sort of makes the dish feel like a complete, fantastic, savory flavor. And this is savory mince. Like, that's the whole game. That's what it is kind of called in various places. And so it's always, to me, seemed really like, well, obviously you would have this savory flavor enhancer in savory mince because it's going to make it even better. But all my pans are heating up. I'm going to do beef mince that I went and got at the butcher and asked him to give me something that was quite good fat content, just so that it tastes better, essentially. Every recipe that I've read says use lean beef mince, which I think is just Australian magazines giving you recipes for mince, like for mince on toast. I do not think my grandma used low-fat beef mince. I would say my parents don't, although this is my granny, like my grandma's mince and a thing I would eat at home, my parents did not use MSG. So it wasn't like a thing that I was using at home when I was a teenager or cooking that much. It was just like an awareness of eating it when I was when I was eating ingredients and eating chicken salt and eating 2-minute noodles and stuff like that. So it's not really until I've been here and cooking much more and like reading about food and cooking and using other people's recipes that I've really started using it as a, oh, well, I'm cooking mince or I'm cooking a meat. It will be fantastic if I add some in. I love it.
So what are you doing at the moment?
Oh, a great question. So the veg is all soft or getting soft. Every recipe you read forever and in all time is like, soften your onions, this will take 3 minutes. So I am softening the onions, which is taking more than 3 minutes, and there's some carrot and celery as well in there now. Onions, celery and carrot are all sort of small dice. The mince is, I think, because I really like my butcher and he did a little bit for me tonight, it's quite a like coarse mince rather than a super super fine, because I think mince on toast is really nice when it's coarse, so you've got like proper texture of the meat in what you're eating. It has unsurprisingly like given off very little water, so it is in a second pan browning up quite nicely on the base, and I put it in without any fat in the pans. There's fat in the pan, there's a bit of butter and oil in the pan with the onion and celery and carrot, but there's none in with the meat because it was quite nice fatty meat. So yeah, I'm going to combine those in a moment, but obviously I don't know if you can hear it, but you might have heard me fill up the kettle. The kettle is boiling and I'm making a bit of stock that's going to go into this as well in a second, when I combine everything. So I'm going to do like stock and seasoning once everything comes together. And then it's so fast. Like, then it will just be reducing that down, putting some frozen peas into it. Very crucial ingredient, crucial step. And yeah, and then just, yeah, reducing it down until it's a consistency that's going to sit nicely on toast.
And is this meal like your kind of go-to comfort meal? Like
it is one of them.
Think of home. Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. It's kind of, I think having it on white toast feels really old school and feels really comforting, because I think so much about food and have talked so much about food and written bits about food over the years. Sometimes I get really in my head about whether I've invented memories or not, whether like the way that I remember a particular dish, whether that's truthful or whether it's just a sort of vibe of the thing. But this is something I really specifically remember eating in my grandma's dining room. And I remember eating it. She, like, the house that she and my granddad had when I was a kid had like a little breakfast room that was a sort of sunny room that had big windows in it that was very narrow, sort of ran along the side of their house. But then the dining room was, and the breakfast room and is where they also had lunch, and that's where we most often were because we were sort of there because we were there on a day off from school or something. Yeah, to sit at the dining table and have mince on toast was really nice, a really nice vibe, a really nice thing.
And where are we?
I'm now seasoning this. So yeah, great timing. I have just put a bit of, I've added everything into one pan and I have added the stock. So I am going to season it with a bit of Worcestershire sauce and curry powder. And then I know it's going to need, because it doesn't really have anything in there apart from the butter, which it's not a huge amount of butter that is at all salty yet. So there's like the stock, but I know this stock really well, so I know it's not as salty as I'm going to want this to be. So I'm going to add a bit of salt. I'm going to let it cook for a little moment, but not all the way to the end. And because I want the salt and the MSG and the pepper to be in here for a while it's cooking down, rather than just seasoning at the end. So I'm going to like under season now, because I know the stock is going to reduce down and it's going to be less liquid. And then I'm going to taste it again before I eat it. But I want it to be in there for a bit while it's all happening. I have come to my freezer and I'm getting frozen peas to put in, because as well, they will add water in because they're frozen. So I just want to make sure that they go in now. Most peas I would add like right at the end, because obviously the more they cook, the sort of like softer they become. I really like these to be really soft because it's the way that they used to be when I was eating it as a kid. Like the peas, I think, traditionally actually go in before this. They go in with the stock, so they are there for a while. So normally I'd be like, if I'm adding peas to a thing, I'm adding it right at the end in the final stir for them just to cook from frozen, and that's it. But these, I think, are going in now, and we'll have the final, like, I reckon we've got 10 more minutes and this will be ready. So they're going to have a good bit of time in this.
So what's the bread that you, what's your go-to bread?
So my go-to bread in life is like the sourdough from the bakery in town. But crucially, this is not a sourdough bread. Dish. This is not a dish to put on top of sourdough. This is a dish to put on like thick white supermarket bread, toast slice rather than sandwich slice, because it's not wet, but it's definitely not dry. So you don't want a thin slice of toast that's going to get soggy immediately. You want something with a bit more crunch and texture. So yes, a toast loaf, toast slice of like white supermarket bread. I have just added like 2 teaspoons of corn flour and the same of cold water in to thicken this up so that it sits nicely on a piece of toast. So corn flour generally needs to cook to, I think it's 80. So it's gone into this while it's boiling and it's going to sit here for a while and do that. But yeah, it needs to cook out so that it doesn't taste floury and odd. But it's, yeah, a nice thickening thing that means it's going to sit better on toast.
Mm-hmm. So you're tasting it again.
I'm now chewing because it's really nice. It is now cooked. I mean, it tastes great. It tastes like, it tastes full comfort. What it, you know, I think that I'm actually adding a little more MSG and a little more salt in the same way that I feel really comforted by a bolognese, because it is a thing that I have both cooked a million times and in a million kitchens and eaten a million times and in a million kitchens. I am really reassured by this as a dish. And in many ways, it's got like a lot of similarities with a bolognese. It's, you know, it is a sofrito base. It is a mince. It is flavoring that goes in on top of that. And in a bolognese, that is like, depending on where you are, maybe that's milk, maybe that's wine, maybe that's tomato, maybe that's, are you making an Australian spag bol or are you making a bolognese from Bologna? There are different versions. They're two different things. But this is like just deeply savory mince. And there is like a sweetness in the pea and a sweetness in the carrot and kind of a sweetness in beef always. But the rest of it is all, the base of it is just deep, savory, good. And deep, savory goodness. And it is going to be fantastic on toast.
This conversation, taking place watching Kate cook on my laptop screen, really brought home the often overlooked reality of how diaspora cooking is both a continuation and an evolution. Food cultures moving around the world, shifting slightly as they go. And umami is a constant in that, bringing comfort to all sorts of people from different places.
I'm Dara Klein. I'm a chef who's currently based in East London. I've had a kitchen residency at the Clopton Arms for almost the last 2 years called Tiella, which is a rustic Italian kitchen. I've been cooking in London since the start of 2019. It's actually the only city I've been a chef in, so it's a big part of my life here. I grew up in New Zealand from the age of 6. My mother is Italian. She's from the Salento region in Puglia, way down in the south. And I was actually born and raised not far outside of Bologna. I was born in a very small village called Correggio and raised in San Giovanni in Persiceto, which is about 40 minutes northwest of Bologna. And my dad's from New Jersey, from the Oranges. I moved to New Zealand just before turning 7, lived there until I was about 18, and then moved to university in Australia. I moved around a bit after graduating from uni. I moved to Sydney for a wee while and then over to New York to be closer to my dad's family.
There is something very familiar in Dara's story. Not only the Aotearoa New Zealand connection, but this idea of encompassing multiple cultural references and heritages. And the complexity of that. Migrants and diaspora people are often balancing a number of different identities. And food can be a wonderful way to see all those influences.
I guess the strongest sense of cultural identity I feel, I've always felt very connected to my Italian side and to my mother's side. In New Zealand, my family owned a trattoria, a very small Italian restaurant that was very intricately linked to our family's existence. And my mother, she's a real Southern Italian. She's got a very strong sense of personal cultural identity. So I think that's really shaped how I felt growing up in New Zealand. It was interesting. I always pined for Italy, and I held quite a complex feeling with New Zealand because I feel really grateful to have grown up here, and I'll always be a home. However, it's mainly when I'm in Italy that I feel this really resounding sense of home and peace. There are certain just emotive washes that come over me that make me feel really, really Italian. However, the American side of my family, I've never really felt super connected to, even though I've grown up really, really close to my father's parents. Their background is Ashkenazi Jewish. My mum being a chef, my dad ran the restaurant with her, so we didn't really eat anything that was sort of Ashkenazi or American in a sense. But I can't deny that growing up between those three places has shaped me into someone who I feel is quite comfortable no matter where they are. My parents, especially my dad, who's always been a traveller at heart, he left America when he was about 19 and moved all over the world. He raised me with the sense that you can find home, you know, in several places around the world if you have the important people and things around you. I would say as a flavor profile, it's probably one of my favorites, just for my own personal palate. I love to eat really umami-rich foods. I think that there are definitely ingredients that you can include which really impart that sort of flavor. You buy really big blocks of parmigiano, really nice sort of 18-month aged parmigiano. You break it down into chunks for service. And then all of the rinds that are kept, I use them anytime when I'm making a stock that doesn't have to be vegan. Or if I'm making like bean-based stews or, you know, bean-based broths, we use the parmesan rinds in the cooking of our ragu as well. I think vegetables have a lot to do with umami. When you apply lengthy cooking times to a nice combination of, you know, the classic sofrito vegetables, it's amazing what a sofrito can do over the course of a really slow cook time if you're caramelizing it tenderly. We also use all the scraps of our salumi as well. We buy Sardinian salumi, but each one is cured with a different herb or curing process. And you know, at the end of the salumi, it's hard to slice for the plate. We just accumulate them all each week and use them in our ragu as well. My mum actually used to cook a lot with seaweed as well. So that's something I haven't used so much at Tiella, but I do a lot in my own personal cooking at home. So this was actually a trick that my first head chef taught me. We'd make these really like reduced umami bombs, he would call them, which would be like a broth that we put together with roasted tomatoes. There'd be mushroom in there. You'd add seaweed, parmesan scraps, all sorts of vegetables and reduce it. Reduce it really, really almost like to a demi-glace point where it's really thick and kind of unctuous. And then you can use it as a tiny scrap into a dish. And it adds a really good touch of flavour and the seaweed, and that makes a really big difference.
So much of Dara's cooking is about doing things slowly, thinking of seasonality and using every element of an ingredient, approaches she's learned from her mother. And with that process comes a lot of umami and savoury notes. She also spoke about the umami in tomatoes. And my favourite tip was about using bay leaves, even in her now famous bay leaf panna cotta. As soon as she talked through her use of bay leaves, I understood how it was indeed a savoury flavour.
Bay leaves, for me, for Italian cooking, are really the one of the most fundamental background flavours that add that initial umami meeting point for the palate. For me, it's really one of the really great round flavours. A lot of people on the internet love to laugh about, you know, oh, what do bay leaves do? But for me, anytime I cook a stew or a lot of vegetable preparation, most things with meat, if I'm braising, roasting, it's always in there. My mum would also make a liqueur out of them too. Honestly, home and food for me is 100% related to my mother's cooking, and especially the cooking in her restaurant, because if I think of the food that I ate of my mum's growing up, it wasn't really in our house. It was in the restaurant. It really ranged season to season. In my own cooking, I'm not trying to replicate. I'm trying to recreate the flavors that my mum had, and especially the processes and the techniques she had.
My heritage is Chinese Malaysian. So I was born in Malacca, but then my family moved to Australia when I was one.
This is Nobby Leong, a polymath, and currently based in Scotland. He holds a PhD in chemistry, is a writer and broadcaster who focuses on Malaysian food, history and culture, and has co-hosted food science documentaries and is right now in Malaysia working on his new podcast, Satay, Okay, which will uncover 500 years of Malaysian history and culture through food. His Instagram is full of delicious cooking videos, some of which break down the science of food and flavour. My favourite is the science of spice and his history of tomato ketchup, appropriate for this episode as it began in China as a fish sauce and influenced condiments such as Worcestershire sauce. In 1812, Americans introduced tomatoes to the ketchup, but it was Heinz that created the sauce style we know today. Go watch Nobby's Instagram post all about it. After Nobby's mother died, he became the accidental custodian of his family's cooking history, which became the catalyst for a cookbook.
I think it forced me to like probe my family's history a little bit more. and I started writing about Malaysian history, I couldn't figure out how my family fit into there. Like, I didn't really understand. And I'd heard my dad tell stories and my mum tell stories. I just didn't understand where they fit. So eventually I sort of started asking people. I found out that my mum's dad, on his journey to Malaysia, like, I think he was born in southern China in somewhere, then was orphaned by two, somehow was in Malaysia by that stage, adopted by a temple, a caretaker, that she died when he was nine, and then he was, I guess, left to fend for himself. And then my grandma, she was also an orphan from about 5 years old, born in Singapore to a wealthy family, then lost the wealth, moved up to Malacca. I figured out my grandpa, I think he, there was always this story about my dad's grandpa that he was like fled to Singapore for 3 years. I'm going to say maybe in the 40s or 50s. Mm. And I remember my dad telling me the story and I didn't really know why. And I'm pretty sure it was because of like when Britain sort of took over Malacca and the administration had shifted to mostly Malay people, him as a Chinese man who worked for the government at the time for some reason, which was also very strange to have a Chinese man working in a Malayan government at the time. Mm. I think he might have been targeted by the Chinese community as like a traitor. And I think he had to flee to Singapore because he fled for his life, because he started working for the British Army in Singapore, helping them translate. And I'm also starting to piece together like why my mum behaved the way that she did around food. You kind of have to cook. Like, the more complex food you cook, the better of a wife you are. Mm. And so that sort of explains a lot of the food that she brought to the table. Mm. And why her perceptions of other people's food, like, she would talk about people making like a roast dinner. She thought this was the easiest thing that you could possibly make, because all you had to do was just put it in the oven.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Her, yeah. And I remember when my grandma would come visit us in Australia, my mum would be so excited to show her, like, this is Hainanese chicken paste in a jar. All you have to do is pour a spoonful of this paste into rice, and you've made chicken rice. And they were so excited by this concept because they no longer had to, like, do all that intense mortar and pestle pounding that they were forced to do before. They could just sidestep all of that and just make it work. And so I think I started to realize more and more what it would have been like for my mum to kind of cook in the foreign country, try and keep the heritage intact, because, you know, food was the only way that we could really practice our culture and the only way that she could pass down that culture to us, because we didn't have, you know, I don't speak any of the various languages she does besides English. Food was that everyday thing that we could constantly go back to. So I started to realize just how difficult that must have been for her, how much knowledge she brought over, then how much she had to kind of adapt to what was available to her in Australia, because obviously the ingredients were not there. Whenever we went back to Malaysia, she would always bring ingredients back with her to Australia, like dried ikan bilis or like belacan blocks from her specific person that she knew in Malacca. And now I find myself doing the same thing. I was in like Malaysia a couple of years ago and I was like, well, this palm sugar looks interesting. I'm not going to be able to get that.
Discussing this idea of balancing complex cooking, time-consuming dishes with availability of ingredients, and the joy of finding jars and products that make home cooking easier, Nobby told me about his grandfather.
So my grandpa loved MSG. So I didn't really know him at all. He died when I was like seven. But he had to have it with every single meal. Every single meal had to be MSG included. So that was interesting. So then I started thinking, okay, if that was the case, he never cooked. My grandma always cooked, or my mum always cooked. So those two people must have been very good at understanding MSG and adding it and knowing how to season with MSG. But then when I started learning from my mum in the 90s and observing her, that was obviously the worst time for MSG in general. So she stopped cooking with any MSG. So I never grew up with MSG in the household. So it made me realize that I've kind of like lost generational knowledge on how to season with MSG because of this, the issue around the 90s. So, you know, because I learned how to passively cook through her. Like if she was seasoning a dish with salt, she would always add a certain amount based on the volume of dish, right? You know.
Yeah.
So that's how I learned to season salt in my thing. But now I don't know how to do that same thing with MSG. And I'm also not sure when I should be using MSG. So obviously, like, you can't just replace all salt with MSG. It would be ridiculous if you put MSG in caramel, I think, to make a MSG caramel, like a salted caramel.
No.
Is it good?
I was very pleased to tell Nobby that actually, Lucy and I had had an amazing salted caramel flan with MSG by Macanese chef Anna DaCosta.
I'm very conflicted by this. Okay, I won't knock it until I try it.
The word umami is a Japanese word to describe the kind of the depthness or the thing that makes things tastier.
This is Chef Song-Soo Kim, who we heard in episode 2.
This doesn't mean that by just using MSG things become flavorful. It's just that kind of thing that accentuates the already current umami that's in some of the dishes. There are dishes in the West that create very similar umami, things like anchovies or salted cod. You know, like Asia, there's a lot of use of soy and fish sauce that is direct, you know, amino liquids that provide immediate umami to lots of dishes.
When we think about this idea of umami and what it does, although we can recognize it in many foods in the West and throughout the world, it is also important to understand that the word and the concept in contemporary times comes from a Japanese heritage. It is a word that has traveled. And there isn't a simple truth or one idea of umami.
I have to be mindful of how the word is used by native speakers in Japan.
Tim Anderson, originally from Wisconsin and now based in the UK, is a chef and cookbook author. I asked Tim about the idea of translation and language and how he, not a native speaker of Japanese, navigates this concept.
When I first started to write about umami, and still mostly this is how I approach it now, I'm quite a hardliner that it is a basic taste, and it doesn't need to be any more complicated than that. But the way it's used in Japan by Japanese speakers is more complicated than that. I've only recently learned this, that there's more than one way of writing the word umami. One uses kanji, one uses hiragana, and they have different meanings. Slightly different meanings, but they are different. And that this has all also been complicated by the way the word is used in sort of traditional fine dining circles like kaiseki and also food marketing. So I have my own perspective on umami, which is basically umami in translation, but there's a different way of understanding it, which does involve a lot of, I think, mythologizing in a way. And sort of aestheticization of umami that I am mindful of, and I'm more mindful of the more I realize, like, oh, there's actually more to this than just a basic taste. That's the sort of basic thing I want to get across, that this is in all of our delicious food, no matter where it comes from. This is why Japanese food is good at it. But yeah, I've been recently not rethinking what umami is, but rethinking sort of how to communicate about it. That's what I've always wanted to avoid, is this sort of mythologizing or sort of needlessly complicating or mysticism, mysticizing, I guess, of umami. I don't want, because there's a lot of that about Japanese food generally, that, and I would really like to avoid that. There was an article in the New Yorker that came out probably 9 years ago or something now, that talked about what umami is, and they were talking about how Japanese chefs in Japan are using it and how they're talking about it, but then also how chefs in New York were talking about it at the time. And I think there was a restaurant called Umami Burger. I don't know if it's still there or what happened to it, but it's so, if you think of it in terms of it being a basic taste, it's so silly to have a company or a brand called that, because it would be like calling it Salty Burger or or having a donut shop called Sweet Donuts. Like, it doesn't actually tell you that much about the food, because all burgers are umami to varying degrees. So yeah, it has become this weirdly problematic word. I still prefer to keep it simple, even though I do have to acknowledge that, like, at least the word and the language of it is complicated, even if the sensation itself and the taste isn't that complicated.
Tim has always used MSG in his cooking and his recipe writing. 9 books over a decade. It is interesting to hear the change of perspective of umami and, of course, MSG.
Whenever I've done cooking demos, umami sort of comes up and so does MSG. I used to sort of ask the audience, using a show of hands, who's heard of umami? 10 years ago, almost no hands would go up. Now, I'd say generally more than half of the hands in any given audience will. But the flip side of that is I used to ask, you know, who here uses MSG in their cooking, and nobody put their hand up. And now still nobody really puts their hands up. So it hasn't got the same sort of mainstream recognition and acceptance that the actual umami sensation has.
And, you know, we think that maybe British food doesn't have umami or is lacking in flavor, but it really doesn't. Like, when you think about all these dishes, they have huge amounts of flavor.
Massively.
And there's a huge amount of the history and the depth of umami.
Big time. And in I think English food gets a really weird global rap for being bland and nothing. And it's just not. There's a lot of really exciting, really good, really fantastically delicious cooking going on in this country. And a lot of it is influenced by the fact that it's a country that people come to and make a home in and bring their own cuisine to, and how exciting it is to eat in a country where you can cross a road and be eating sort of really fantastic dishes made by people who are coming from all across the world. I have not toasted yet. I've got the mince here that is sitting there. So I might toast up now and put some mince on top. And that is going to be the last bit of my little cooking, my little cooking for the evening.
Next time on To Be Delicious.
It's also that the science is about the codifying of it and understanding what that is, but it's almost like, yeah, fine, but that's all, like, the actual expression of it is way more important, and that's just existed. Like, it's always great, and I obviously believe in the pursuit of science and the understanding of things, but it's where you get that intersection with the human side, the social side, the cultural element, that's where it becomes something really special.
Delicious was presented by me, Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing, and produced for Lekker by me and Lucy Dearlove. Our original theme music was composed by Midori Yeager. Our podcast artwork was by Natasha Pang Lee. This project was made possible by the support of the European Committee for Umami and Ajinomoto. Thank you very much for listening, and just a little note, we have been recording this on my sofa in the living room with a very sleepy Jonah making very loud snores, so hopefully you've enjoyed those too, adding to the nostalgia and comfort. If you're enjoying the series, please leave a rating and review for Lekker on Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners find the podcast. If you've enjoyed this series, you'll also enjoy my first book, Chinese and Any Other Asian, Exploring East and Southeast Asian Identity in Britain, out now, which you can order on the link in the show notes for this episode.